We're looking at Psalm 4 this evening. It's a brief psalm, so I'm going to read it again so that its content is fresh in our minds before we begin to have a look at it. Psalm 4, a psalm of David. Answer me when I call you, O my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me and hear my prayer. How long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call him to him. In your anger, do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and trust in the Lord. Many are asking, who can show us any good? Let the light of your countenance shine upon us, O Lord. You have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. I will lie down and sleep in peace. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. I think that we can properly refer to this psalm as an evening prayer. These are the things that were going through David's mind as he sought to settle down to sleep. The evening, particularly now as we're approaching winter, can sometimes be quiet and dark and cold and lonely. The approach of night can sometimes lead us to brood. Can be an occasion on which we begin to reflect on things, and different issues creep into our minds, some of them not so welcome. The situations that we find ourselves in, the influences that are bearing down upon us, the people with whom we have relationships of various kinds, these things may become magnified. What will we do with them? How will we answer them? How will we cope with them? Will they unsettle us to the point where they will deprive us of sleep? Are we going to toss and turn with anxiety so that we will be asleep or completely evade us? The psalm seems to reflect the kind of state of mind that somebody may be in those circumstances. It seems to move quickly from one subject to the next subject. Subjects and influences and concerns that are potentially troubling the psalmist's mind as he seeks to settle down to go to sleep. And they all rush in or creep into his mind. And so this psalm is in its own way highly personal. That's not to say that it shouldn't be read in public or sung in public. It is indeed for the director of music with stringed instruments, a psalm of David for worship, just because David's own intensely personal experience and the benefit that he got from turning these thoughts over to God are of universal interest to all of God's people. The outline that I'm following this evening follows very closely to that of very helpful commentator, Derek Kidner, so I simply acknowledge that. As I do so, he picks up on verse 1 and the final verse, verse 8, and makes the point that verse 1 is describing well-founded prayer and verse 8, well-founded peace. And then in verses 2 and 3, 4 and 5, 6 and 7, David, by God's grace, as he turns these issues that are assaulting his mind over to God, as he is thinking about the influence, perhaps of his companions, his friends, and his enemies, he finds a gracious answer to each of these issues that are troubling him and would be upsetting his sleep. I've referred to sleep and the disruption of sleep and the inability to sleep, both in my prayer and now in my introduction to our consideration of Psalm 4. You may think that that is a wholly unspiritual theme to be thinking about in a service of worship on Sunday evening. Well, it wasn't to David in Psalm 3, nor was it to David in Psalm 4, and I hope to show you in due course that the whole matter of a good night's sleep may well be a thoroughly spiritual issue. Well, let's start off by looking at verse 1 under the heading, Well-Founded Prayer. Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God, give me relief from my distress, be merciful to me and hear my prayer. Or, and a number of the translations put a portion of that verse in the past tense, and I think it's very helpful to see it in those terms. Answer me when I call you, O God of my righteousness, or O my righteous God, you have relieved me in my distress, be gracious to me and hear my prayer. It seems that here in the closing hours of the day, as the night draws near, and as these matters begin to close in on David's mind, he turns, as every godly person ought to do in those circumstances, he turns his mind to God and to pray to God. And as he does so, he reminds himself of the great foundation upon which God's people may turn to him in prayer with confidence. And the first thing that comes to his mind is God's righteousness. Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. That is the most basic reassurance that we can call to mind in the midst of our difficulties, as we seek to approach God in prayer. Now, we've been through a few psalms recently, and I think from time to time, and perhaps you're finding the repetition a little bit repetitive, a little bit dull, the idea that here in the psalms in particular, the idea that God is righteous is not threatening to us as conceived of as sinners, but rather it's encouraging to us as we understand ourselves to be God's people. Certainly, that's David's approach. As he comes to God, what is the thing that causes him to cry out to God in confidence? It's precisely because God is righteous. And I think we can understand it in these simple terms. He is confident that God will do what is right. Isn't that what you need? When you come to God in prayer, when you are in a swirl of circumstances, where you're being influenced by a whole range of people that have a whole range of motives, where the whole situation seems to be an uncontrolled mess, and then what you do in those fearful, quiet moments when you're on your own and you turn to God and you have this as the bedrock of your confidence in him, God is in control and he will do in these circumstances, and in response to my prayer, what is right. I don't know how that strikes you, but that seems to me to be a tremendous encouragement. God will do what is right. He knows what is right. And he has the authority and the power and the wisdom to do what is right. Take that to heart, and it will encourage you to pray. To pray to him as, O my righteous God. But then if we to take the second part of verse 1 as the past tense, David is basing his confidence as he prays to God, not only on God's righteousness, but on past experience, the past experience of God. Let me read it to you again in the other translation. You have relieved me in my distress. David is reflecting and he's saying, well, I may be confronted by a range of difficulties that I don't really know how to handle and answer, but this I know, that in the past, when I have called upon God, God has heard me. He's saying to himself, I have been in distress before. The word means that I've been hard pressed. I've been in a tight corner. I've been squeezed. There's been no room to maneuver or to move. And I called out to God in my distress. And quite literally, what he says is that God made room for me. God gave me space. God brought relief. That has been my experience of him. I don't really want to say any more than that of verse 1, because I think to say more than that would obscure the wonderful truth. This is well-founded prayer. Everyone, in those reflective, silent, personal, private moments, when circumstances seem to be so foreboding that you don't know whether you're going to get a good night's sleep, David is saying, turn to God in prayer and have this confidence. He's a righteous God. He will do what is right. And remember that when you have turned to him in your distress in the past, he heard you and gave you relief, and you may have confidence that he will do it again. Now, as we proceed, it seems that in the following pairs of verses that David is now thinking about his companions or his enemies or the people who surround him who are having various kinds of influences upon him. And he's reflecting on those circumstances, and he's able, by God's grace, to answer them. So verse 2 opens, "How long, O men?" So his mind is turning then just to the reality of the people who are surrounding him and having an influence on him. And verses 2 to 3 then, for our second point, is entitled "An Answer to the Perverse." "How long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions? Or how long will you love what is worthless and seek false gods or aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him." Which men is he referring to? He's referring to perverse men. David here is thinking about the people who are around him who are corrupt and who corrupt others. I think if we, our mind turn to Titus chapter 1, and I think that the way Paul described a certain a kind of people in Titus chapter 1 verses 15 and 16 is the kind of people and the kind of influence that David has in mind. "To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are corrupted and do not believe, nothing is pure. In fact, both their minds and consciences are corrupted. They claim to know God, but by their actions they deny him. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for doing any good." It seems that David is here describing people who see no value in a good thing, but see value in worthless things. They are perverse. Their value system is entirely inverted and reversed. "Oh, how long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame?" Perhaps what David is doing is reflecting on his own position then as king. David is God's anointed king. Remember Psalm 3, and I think Psalm 4 follows, is connected to Psalm 3. He's fleeing from his son Absalom. There is there's mutiny. There is rebellion. There's rebellion against David's position as king. Now, David is God's anointed king. He's been set apart by God in order to rule God's people. It's to be a reign that is to be a blessing to the people of God. God has set it up for those, for that purpose. He's to rule God's people in righteousness. He is to judge them according to God's law. He is in his rule over his people. He is to restrain evil. He's to promote the worship of God. So David's rule, his kingship and his dynasty was supposed to be and intended to be a glorious thing, a blessing to the people. David, the greatest of all of the kings. He holds his position not just democratically not just because he's inherited that position, but as a consequence of God's specific promise. His kingship, as we know from the Old and New Testament, was a foreshadowing of Christ. Everything about it was planned by God. It was honorable. It was glorious. It was good. But here, he's being rebelled against. His own son is against him, seeking to usurp his position, to murder him. It's just, there's no recognition of a good thing when it's staring you in the face. That's the kind of people that he's dealing with. "To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are corrupted, nothing is pure." People who oppose him, who cannot see any good in the position that he holds. Now, you may say, well, that's very interesting, but perhaps not so interesting. That's long ago, far away, and has no relevance to me, because I'm not King David with those kind of opponents in Israel. But we also are surrounded by people who are corrupt, and to them nothing is pure. But thus the things that we value most are also being constantly trashed. The name of Jesus is blasphemed. The moral values that we seek to live by and that we aspire to are utterly degraded, and the degradation of them is presented graphically to us as entertainment. Our cherished beliefs as Christians that we hold, that we admire, that we believe they're honorable, are ridiculed as fundamentalism. The church is a laughing stock. Christian parents who are seeking to raise their children in the fear and admonition of the Lord and seeking to discipline their children according to the word of God are more or less considered as child abusers. Are you teaching your child to believe in a God who has created the world rather than in evolution? Well, you're sneered at. And so we also are surrounded by a world of people who are influencing us in such a way that there is nothing that they consider or speak about or write about or think about or touch, but they corrupt it with their own corruption. They see no value in a good thing. But the very opposite is true. They see value in worthless things. Verse 2 in the American Standard Bible. How long will you love what is worthless? They love, they esteem what is worthless. Isn't that so? Every now and again when we watch a decent program on television, we don't switch the thing off early enough, and we see the first few minutes of the next thing that we hadn't intended to watch, and so much of it is absolute worthless drivel and trash, isn't it? We're in a world of talentless popular musicians who are idolized. And professional footballers who are paid £120,000 a week, some of them, for being nothing more than entertainers. And there are people who have become famous for being famous because they've participated in a reality television program where it's actually now a recognized phenomenon, fame without talent. Even the world can see what a ridiculous situation they've created. And so this corrosive spirit is alive in our day as much as it was in David's. And so you might go home this evening then, and as you switch off the light and before you go to sleep, you may be troubled by the thought that you're being influenced by this corrosive world in which people see no value in a good thing. In fact, they're happy to trash what we hold dear. And they seem to celebrate and create celebrities around utterly valueless and worthless things. But David has an answer. Know, verse 3, that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call to him. The world may not value the godly, but the Lord does. The Lord may place no value on the church of Jesus Christ, but the Lord does. The world may not lay any value on spiritual things, but the Lord does. And that's the great antidote. The world may not give the godly a moment's attention, but the Lord listens to us when we cry to him. And so, if we do raise our voices as we seek to proclaim and defend God and his truth, and we get no hearing from a world that values the worthless and places no value on the treasure that we present to them in our preaching of the gospel, when we raise our voice heavenwards to God and call, the Lord will hear us. So he comforts his heart against the background of the men that he's addressed in verse 2, who are corrupt and perverse and whose corrosive influence is bothering David. David has an answer, and it's the answer that we must hold to as well. The Lord has set apart the godly for himself. He values the godly. He loves us, he owns us, and he hears us when we cry to him. I suggested to you earlier that in this intensely personal psalm, where David is facing the things that are troubling him, one thing seems to come after another. They don't necessarily seem to us to be entirely related, and perhaps they aren't, because that's perhaps just exactly what our experience is so often like. And so, very briefly then, number three, an answer to the hothead. That's the way Derek Kidner puts it, and I think maybe that's quite helpful. So verses 4-5. In your anger, do not sin. When you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Of course, this is a text that is quoted by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26, which seems to make it clear that that David here is speaking about people who are angry. It seems that if in verse 2 he's describing men who have absolutely no loyalty to him whatsoever, it could be that verse 4 he's thinking of men who if it could be too much loyalty, who are provoked to anger against these circumstances and who are already without thought to fly to David's defense, and that would be an entirely inappropriate way of defending him. So it could be that those are the circumstances. Very difficult to tell what gave rise to this thought in David's mind in verse 4. And his answer seems to be, calm down. Sleep on it. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. It's right, as the Apostle Paul says, to be angry. When you're surrounded by men who are corrupt and see no value in good things, and you see too much value in worthless things, and you may be aroused to an anger that is a sinful kind of anger, don't allow yourself to be aroused in that way. But when you are on your beds, search your hearts, keep your counsel, be silent, exercise self-control and restraint. And that seems to be the thought that is going through his mind. A godly perspective on a challenging situation. Well, we hurry on then to the fourth point, an answer to the pessimist. So, verses 6 and 7. In verse 6, the pessimist is introduced. Many are asking, so he's still thinking now about the influence of other people, so he's surrounded by the influence of influential people, his companions and his enemies and his friends, and here are a new bunch of people, and what they're doing is they're posing this question: who can show us any good? This seems to be the pessimist, as Derek Kidner puts it, the doleful. Many people, there are these people, other people in David's life, and they're saying, where is any good going to come from? Give up hope. It's not worth even trying any longer. All hope is extinguished. Doleful pessimists have become hopeless, jaded, lost all expectation, an influence that we ourselves know too well. And that we may be prone to ourselves. Oh, the church is in terminal decline. Oh, the state of things in this country. Things used to be so good. You can read about it. You can go off to the Banner of Truth books and you can find reference to the past, to history, to the great works of God and the revivals in Wales and so on and so on. And oh, it was so good in those days, but today, well, everything has gone downhill. Everything has just, all of that has dissipated. Spiritual legacy that we've got, we've completely wasted, and so there's no hope left. True spirituality in this country, it's rare, it's almost extinct. Where do you find it? Where do you find Christians and groups of Christian people who value God, value His Word, value doctrinal truth, who have reverence for God and seek to worship Him according to His Word? Oh, it's all gone. See, where is there any hope? Who can show us any good? There's no good to be found anywhere. Evangelism, it's useless. It's a waste of time. Oh, look at all that we've done in the past. We've attempted to do this. The bookstore and the knocking on doors and the carol services. And oh, such a minimal response. Who can show us any good? There's no hope, no expectation. Let's not waste our time. Why waste time on mission? The day of mission is surely over. Borders are closed. Islam has got a tight grip over so many nations and peoples. Converts are threatened with death. Don't waste your time. Don't spend money on it. Don't send people abroad because they obviously can't make any progress. They're going to have entry visas denied them. And when they get in there, then they're going to be evicted. And if they secure converts, then those converts are going to be murdered and killed. And so you're going to have secret conversions and secret baptisms. See, it's that kind of idea, I think, that here David, in this evening hour, is facing. The sort of jaded cynicism of his companions who can't find any hope that there will be any good. David has an answer to that as well. It is the answer of faith, and it starts in the second half of verse 6. Let the light of your face shine upon us, O Lord. It can all be changed. The perspective can be totally shifted by bringing God back into the reckoning, by calling upon God rather than saying, there's no use. By trusting that just by the Lord smiling upon us, that alone will reinvigorate our courage and give us hope. The Lord lifting up the light of his countenance upon his people. When all else is in decline, David is saying, when everything else seems to drive us to jaded cynicism, turn to God and trust in him. And we have every reason to believe that we will find in God what is described here in verse 7, heart filled with greater joy even than the people of the world experience when their bank balances are full and they're overflowing with wealth and riches. And so David then comes to the end of the psalm, the closing verse in verse 8. Here are all these influences, these men, these people, these companions, these opponents, and from one angle or another they've challenged his faith. The perverse, the hothead, and the pessimist. And it's the kind of these are the kind of thoughts that could keep you awake all night, couldn't they? But David says, I will lie down and sleep in peace. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. And so our fifth and final point is well-founded peace. I said earlier that sleep may seem to be an altogether unspiritual theme to take up on a Sunday evening, but I think sleep may well be a thoroughly spiritual issue. I'm not saying that it always is. If you're not sleeping well, maybe you need exercise, or maybe you need to take a sleeping tablet now and again, or maybe there are other adjustments that you need to make to your lifestyle. So I'm sure it's not all a spiritual issue, and if you're losing sleep, then you may not necessarily have any spiritual issues to deal with. But sleep here is a spiritual issue. It was certainly a spiritual issue for David, as I think I've already pointed out in Psalm 3. David was fleeing from Absalom, his son. His life was under threat. The throne was under threat. His life was really and truly at risk. And in those circumstances, sleep was physically a very hard thing to achieve in the midst of being constantly on the run, out in the wilderness, finding a cave to hide in. Here and there. Sleep was emotionally hard to get, filled with anxiety, wondering whether, if he fell asleep, It would place him in a position of such vulnerability that he would never wake up again because he would be found and murdered. A spiritual issue because of his fearfulness and anxiety in the midst of these troubles. Was God going to deliver him? Would God preserve him? Was it worthwhile calling upon God? And in Psalm 3, he was able in those circumstances to say in verse 5, I lie down and sleep. And then I wake again, alive, you see, because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. And so it's a profoundly spiritual issue whether he gets a night's sleep and survives it in Psalm 3. And similarly in Psalm 4, will these niggling concerns corrode his mind and his heart so that he's filled with anxiety that keeps him from trusting in God and praying to God and leaves him tossing and turning right through the night so that he has a restless night without sleep? Or is he able to rest his soul's concerns upon God and turn them over to him in prayer and then lie down and lay his head upon his pillow and sleep in peace in the confidence that the Lord and the Lord alone is able to make him dwell in safety? I don't know what's making you awake at night. I don't know what's making you toss and turn at the moment. What attitude of others, what threat, what disappointment, what fear. And that for you is undoubtedly your sleeplessness, a spiritual issue. I encourage you then in the spirit of Psalm 4, in the spirit particularly of its first and its last verse, to place your confidence in God, to turn your needs over to him, to trust in his righteousness, that in these circumstances, as you trust in him, he will do right. And that as he has given relief in the past when you've called out to him, that he will give you relief again in your distress. So that by his grace, though all of the problems may not immediately evaporate, you will be able to, verse 8 reads, I think literally like this, both lie down and sleep in peace. Because so often it's lying down, but there's no sleep and there's no peace. So sleeping is a spiritual issue. And sometimes our lack of sleep is indicative of faithlessness, unbelief, an inability to trust God, when what we need is by God's grace the ability to find an answer in faith to all of the issues that are troubling us, to turn them over to him, to find relief, and to feel safe, and lay down our heads and sleep.